Welcome to How to Fix It. I'm John Avalon, author, journalist, historian, and the purpose of this podcast is finding solutions to the problems we face, not just endlessly fixating on the problems. But the problems are piling high at the Justice Department this week and recent days with the indictment of a former director of the FBI, longtime U.S. attorney, James Comey, which seems like a new low in the politicization of justice and the persecution of Donald Trump's enemies. Joining me to talk about it is my buddy Ellie Honig of CNN fame, also author of the new book, When You Come at the King. He has chronicled the political... There, we look at you with the product placement there. Very nice.
They won't let me leave without it, yeah.
Always be selling, as they say. Ellie, just when you thought things couldn't get worse... There's the cellar has a basement, doesn't it?
You know, first of all, great to see you, John. Great to chat with you. And you're the perfect guy for this issue in this moment. In the book, you know, what I do is I go back through and I have a chapter and I talk to people, firsthand people, 36 people, prosecutors, defense lawyers, but Watergate all the way up through Jack Smith's case. And if you look back to the chapter, the third to last chapter, which is about the Mueller case, and talking about like... It's remarkable to look at how different Trump 2.0 is from Trump 1.0, starting with the fact there will be no Mueller, there will be no inward-looking anything in this investigation. And also, if you remember, my first book was about Bill Barr, negative piece about Bill Barr, called Hatchet Man. And one of Bill Barr's few redeeming qualities is when Trump would take to social media and say, I want to see my enemies indicted. I want to see Barack Obama, John Kerry, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, you name it. Barr just ignored him. He just, like the way you would ignore a toddler having a tantrum and it would pass. Now they're doing it. Now it's real. And that's a big difference.
That is a big difference. You know, Ellie, there's a quote from Hannah Arendt that I've been thinking a lot about generally, but this situation specifically, when they effectively forced out a sitting U.S. attorney who wouldn't apparently do the dirty work, and Pam Bondi and co replaced her with someone who seems all too willing to persecute the enemies. Here's what the quote Hannah Arendt said. Totalitarianism, and I want to say she's speaking about totalitarianism, right, but the idea still applies. Totalitarianism in power invariably replaces all first-rate talents, regardless of their sympathies, with those crackpots and fools whose lack of intelligence and creativity is still the best guarantee of their loyalty.
We are seeing that personnel is everything. Again, look back at the first Trump administration. You had Bill Barr, who I was very critical of, and stand by all that, but he had a line that he wouldn't cross and eventually, you know, ended up leaving Trump in bad graces because of that. You had Mattis and Kelly and Milley and some gatekeepers, and now there is no place for them. Look at what happened in this case. The U.S. attorney, who was an experienced conservative guy who was there because of Trump, refused to do it, refused to bring this case. And so Trump got rid of him and brought in this Lindsay Halligan, who has no prosecutorial experience. And the first thing she does is okay this case, essentially. So yeah, I think there's something to that. I think Trump understands that the number one thing you need to do what you want to install your agenda is to have the people who will do whatever you want in place.
And this is why in some ways the original sin is the Senate confirmation of people like Kash Patel, of people like Pete Hegseth. Yeah. And it relates to the DOJ. You're dealing with a specific culture that's been uprooted. From that perspective, right, the firing of an existing USA, replacement with a lackey who'll do whatever you say, how dangerous is this indictment and how flimsy is this indictment?
Well, let's start with the flimsy side. I mean, the thing is, like, the indictment itself is threadbare. There's nothing – it's hard to even know what the allegation is. All you know is they say Comey said – Comey testified he never authorized a leak, and that was a lie. You can't tell anything more than that. And an indictment doesn't have to lay out the whole case, but it has to at least give the defendant a reasonable opportunity to know what he's charged with to defend himself. Now, the prosecutors will have to disclose more information about their charges pretty quickly. But at the moment, we don't even know exactly which leak they're talking about, which authorized leaker. Could be Andy McCabe, could be Daniel Richmond. There's various candidates, and that will impact what we perceive as the strength of the case. Bigger picture, though, what we're seeing is the complete just evisceration of this wall that has long existed between the White House and the political operation of the executive branch and the Justice Department's prosecutorial function. Now, I don't suggest that DOJ can or should just operate on its own island. They are part of the executive branch. They do have politically accountable leaders, the AG, the U.S. attorneys. But when politicians, when the president gets involved in dictating who gets charged and who doesn't, prosecutorial decisions, then we have crossed the line. And that's something that both parties for decades, I talk about this in the book, presidents don't always love it. Presidents would like to have more control over prosecutors. But even going back to Nixon, they've always understood that there has to be some independent prosecutorial function. But that's changing now very quickly.
But and I think the word the verb changing maybe too, or you know, it may be too little passive there, right? I mean, Elliot Richardson quits when Nixon tells him to do his dirty work. Now you have prosecutors being fired and replaced with lackeys who make Robert Bork look like, you know, a giant of jurisprudence, right?
I'm glad you raised that example because I want to talk about that for a second. Yes, Elliot Richardson quits, William Ruckelshaus quits rather than firing Archibald Cox, right? This is the Saturday Night Massacre. I talked to two of the prosecutors who were on the team. But I actually argue in the book that Robert Bork is misremembered because Bork is typically remembered the way you said, John, is the bad guy, the willing executioner who came in and fired Cox. But if you dig in, both Richardson and Ruckelshaus years later said, we begged him to do that. We told him, you don't quit because we need someone to stop the bleeding. We need a tourniquet here. And now they screwed him because they kind of led him down this primrose path. He was bitter because it was used against him when he was up for the Supreme Court in 87.
Well, by the way, obviously, I mean, the fact that Reagan appointed him when he was the henchman in the Saturday Night Massacre, whatever institutional defense you want to do, he did the thing that they quit before he did. And that, to me, it's always been like, how did Reagan nominate? I mean, whatever genius of conservative jurisprudence, it's leading with your chin, not to make a joke about his chin sling.
That's a question. That's a question for Reagan. But, you know, both guys who quit supported him later. And also, he, because he came in, he dispatches Archibald Cox, but then he stands up to Nixon and he says, you have to appoint a new independent prosecutor. And that's a big part of the reason why a couple of weeks later we get Leon Jaworski, which leads to the making of the case. Leon Jaworski.
Good. That is a really important context. Your book is about the special prosecutor. But to your point, we are, you know, that looks like a quaint instrument of restraint.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, what we're viewing now, I mean, we could talk about whatever is happening to John Bolton, but now we're seeing that the promises to persecute Donald Trump's enemies, which he said was going to stop, quote unquote, he felt persecuted, not prosecuted. I'd take issue with that all day long. But now this is just a revenge bender that's going to leave destruction in its wake to our Constitution and to the Justice Department. So I don't want to sound alarmist here, but I don't want to be Pollyannish either. How bad is what's being broken?
Oh, this is one of the core tenets of our government. I mean, you have to have an independent Justice Department. Now, I don't argue that DOJ should be able to do whatever it wants and that everyone at DOJ is automatically, you know, a white knight who only knows virtue. It is a political creation. It is a part of our executive branch. There needs to be political accountability. But, you know, what's interesting, there's no law per se saying DOJ must be separate and independent from the White House, from the president. I mean, if you went to court and said, I want to sue because I think DOJ is no longer independent, you wouldn't have a leg to stand on. This is more along the lines of a long established foundational norm and tradition that both parties have long observed and respected. And part of the book is about ways that that has been chipped away over the years. But whether it's Nixon or Clinton, and they're not all equal, but Nixon or Clinton or Trump one or Biden, they've all chipped away at that wall in various ways. But now here comes Trump 2.0 and it's over. He just dynamites it. But this is one of those things that's like not really enforceable. I mean, yes, Jim Comey can go into court and argue that he's being selectively prosecuted. And I think he's going to win on that. Given the things Trump has said and posted on social media publicly, he makes the case for him. But it's not like, well, my Fourth Amendment constitutional right is being violated. My First Amendment constitutional right is being violated. It's just really like good government that we've long recognized that is now totally scrapped.
That's something worth not glossing past. I mean, we have a written constitution, but there is an unwritten part of the constitution, which is rooted in concepts of honor, decency, and common sense, as the founders intended and as everyone has recognized. And, you know, the rest of the quote, Rome wasn't built in a day, was it burnt in one. And Trump is burning something. And I want to talk to you about how to fix it, because to your point, there's no reason to think it's going to stop here, right? I mean, FBI shows outside John Bolton's house. You've got Letitia James next on the list. I mean, God, Trump basically by mistake published a DM demand to his AG that in any other environment would be seen as a smoking gun for abuse of executive power. And now it just seems like something that happened two Fridays ago, and who can remember or care?
Right. So I do think more people will get indicted on the hit list. He gave us a hit list. He listed it in that. You know, I know there's speculation if it's a DM that he inadvertently posted. It has hallmarks of both. Bolton, I'm going to hold off on because I want to see that indictment. Look, there's no question Trump hates Bolton and would delight in seeing him in cuffs. But given the reporting that I'm seeing, and it's still early, he may have done something that needs to be addressed. I'm going to wait until I pass judgment on that one. But look, I've looked at the allegations against Letitia James. You know, I've been a critic, a sharp critic of Letitia James. But this mortgage fraud case is bogus. It's bonkers. I mean, basically in one spot, she bought this home in Virginia. In some one power of attorney form, it says that will be her primary home. But every other document says it will not be. It will be her secondary home. At one point, there's an email where she says, this will not be my primary home. So it's like, you've done a mortgage. There's 20 million pages in it. That's not intentional fraud. What kind of fraud would that be? So I want to see if she...
Well, and isn't it eerily similar with what they're charging the member of the Federal Reserve with? Also,
yeah, but her, Lisa Cook, her conduct seems a little more deliberate and a little less explainable than Letitia James's, as Letitia James's seems to be genuinely a one page of error. Lisa Cook did it in a more systematic way, and there's a little more inconsistency there. But the point is, the reason that they're onto these people is they have this guy, Bill Pulte, who's another Trump loyalist. He donated over $1 million to Trump's various political outlets, who is now the head of the Federal Housing Finance Agency. Ordinarily, you'd go, what the heck is that? Who cares? But it's become... It sort of has echoes of the IRS scandal, where during the Obama era, without the president being involved, there's a big difference. But during the Obama administration, IRS officials were picking out files to audit based on ideology, mostly conservative. Now you have this guy.
Yeah, I think you want to be careful about the characterization.
Okay, tell me.
I remember covering that at the time. There were questions about people abusing nonprofit status, but it was not just for conservative outlets. It was done in the context of the Tea Party, but it was about people forming a lot of bogus political entities and basically fleecing them. And that seemed like an enforcement mechanism, but it was characterized at the time as persecution. And I think
that's a good nuance. But this Pulte guy appears to be just like pulling files of people they want out. You know, Lisa Cook, we don't want her on the Fed board because she's not voting for lower interest rates. Someone take a look. You know, I mean, it can't be a coincidence that he's just churning out these referrals on all.
Why did Billy Long, the newly appointed head of the IRS, quit all of a sudden?
Right. I mean, that's a good question too. So, I do expect to see more of this, and there's not a great way to stop it during the Trump administration other than these people going to court and winning. But I don't know if Trump cares. Do you think Trump cares? Like, if the Comey case, first of all, the Comey case has been assigned to a Biden appointed judge. Now, I don't subscribe to the view that whatever president appointed you, you're in the bag. I was hoping it would go to a Republican appointed judge because I believe that the selective prosecution defense will succeed and will knock this out. But I believe this is my inclination before trial. And now, you know, whatever happens, Trump's going to say, this Biden appointed liberal, blah, blah, blah. But if it was a Bush judge or a Trump one judge, it would be much harder to make that claim. And it's kind of it's fortune or misfortune. It's just random luck. But I was hoping it would be a Republican appointee for that reason. I don't want him to be able to say it's a fix.
But that said, you know, look, man, how many Trump and Republican appointed judges did we point to when the election lie was being knocked down left and right in 60 courts and the Trump, you know, crew just didn't, you know, refute logic. It's impervious to logic.
Yeah.
Right. But this is incredibly dangerous, it seems to me, for the defense of the rule of law, the degradation of the rule of law, because there are two ways to go after this. Right. One is that you get an equal and opposite reaction.
Yeah.
And Republicans will scream bloody murder, but they started it, right? Or you get someone who tries to strengthen the institutions. That's far better for our country. And the question is, how do you do it if some of it's unwritten? If it's just rooted in common decency and common sense and a sense of character, and you've seen so many people, including the guy you worked with, Todd Blanche, and I want to know more about this. Just, it's that combination of cowardice and careerism that ends up enabling, you know, the destruction of things that have upheld our democracy that have been hard won. How do you understand that? How do you fix
it? Part of the pitch in my book at the end is basically directed to whoever is the next whoever's the 48th president of the United States. God knows who that person will be. And basically the pitch is when you take office, you will find that a lot of guardrails have been destroyed. Not just this whole notion of independent counsel, special counsel, and independent Justice Department, but inspectors general and independent quasi, you know, agencies, the FTC and the FCC and, you know, the Merit Systems Protection Board and restrictions on profit making while you're in office. All that stuff is gone. And it's going to be mighty tempting for you, President 48, to look around and go, yeah, who really wants that stuff? Like, I don't, it'd be better for me to just leave it dead. But my argument in this book is if you look back at the history, you see that this has been a highly imperfect institution. Every one of these cases has warts and has missteps, but it's so vital that we have a independent DOJ and some substantial mechanism to investigate a president and to hold a president criminally accountable. And so I don't have much of a better pitch other than it's necessary and good government. I can't, if the next president is as self-interested as Trump, I'm not going to be able to change that person's mind.
Obviously not, but I guess I'm not, what I'm suggesting is, as the founders understood, that you needed a system that could withstand, you know, people that don't hold themselves to the high standards. And we've done pretty well over there. But the entire point of the system the founder structured was, how do you stop a tyrant who's democratically elected? And so what I'm suggesting is maybe that there are things that were norms that need to be strengthened. Maybe, you know, the Justice Department should be officially independent from the executive. What are some of the laws and proposals or reforms that could be put in place? Because this way lies fire and ashes.
Yeah. So this is the last two chapters of the book. And I lay out a way, a proposal. And I pulled this both from scholarly articles, law review articles, but also from talking to all the people I talked to, Watergate prosecutors, presidential defense lawyers, you name it. I said, when, you know, they all operate under slightly different rules. There were several eras, but I said, what rules, what laws, what aspects of the system worked for you? What aspects sort of tripped you up? And what I propose is essentially we need a semi-permanent special counsel's office within the Justice Department. It actually could be, you know, could be located. There's a public integrity section, a person who would have to be presidentially nominated, Senate confirmed. That would give you some level of political accountability and should weed out ultra partisans, a set year of terms, could be 5 or 10 years, that carries across administrations with high level protections against firing, because, you know, the FBI director is supposed to be 10 years, but Trump just fired Comey and would have fired Chris Wray, but Chris Wray saw that coming and so he quit.
Who was his own appointee, by the way, of course, Biden kept.
So, you know, it's not impervious to somebody who's just absolutely determined to Godzilla it and just, you know, burn it down and stomp on it. But it would hold up in a way that I think is sturdier than just the way special counsel now is just sort of at the whim of the AG and it's case by case. If we had a more permanent institution with a degree of independence, but also accountability. So there's no perfect system. There are criticisms of the system that I put up there, but it would definitely be a more sturdy system than what we have now.
This show is sponsored by Cornbread Hemp. I'm sure a lot of you are looking for natural ways to relieve aches and stress and discomfort. And who isn't looking for a little more peace of mind in our dystopian times? So we got some good news. These CBD gummies from Cornbread Hemp are formulated to work with your body, not against it. Cornbread Hemp's CBD gummies are made to help you feel better, whether it's stress, discomfort, just need a little more relaxation on demand. Now, I, full disclosure, have not historically been a big CBD guy, but these are federally legal, and I stress federally legal, way to unwind that doesn't involve bourbon. So I'm recommending to friends who are trying to drink less because, oh boy, it really starts to catch up with you as you get older. Cornbread Hemp only uses the best part of the hemp plant, the flower, for the purest and most potent CBD. All products are third-party lab-tested and USDA organic to ensure safety and purity. And right now, How to Fix It listeners can save 30% on their first order. Just head to cornbreadhemp.com/fixit and use the code FIXIT, all caps, at checkout. That's cornbreadhemp.com/fixit and use the code fix it. There's no perfect system because we're humans, right? I mean, the question is how do you create a system that restrains abuse? And part of the problem with what you're suggesting in a macro sense about the 48th yep. president is that a lot of the criticisms of Biden in the rearview mirror was that Merrick Garland was too establishment and institutionally minded to take the actions necessary to deal with an attempt to overturn an election by a sitting president and his lackeys. And that attempt, that he was so concerned rightfully with making sure that the institution was strengthened, that he didn't deal with the existential danger that then got us in this position.
You and I are lockstep on this. And John, we cover this together. I mean, I was shouting from the, as were you, from the rooftops from, you know, within a couple weeks of Garland taking office in early 21, that he is not focused on the top here. He had this bogus line of, we're going to build our way up. That's how you build cases, facts and law, blah, blah, blah. But as I and other former prosecutor said, that's not what you do. When you have evidence that the guy at the top, if when I was doing mob cases, if I had evidence on a capo or an underboss, I wouldn't go, okay, but hold on. Let me stop. Let me go down to the guys on the corners and then work. I mean, no, you go as high as, you know, the highest point of available entry is where you go. And I get into this in the book. The Jack Smith chapter in this book opens with the line, Jack Smith never had a chance. By the time Merrick Garland finally appointed him, November of 2022, 2 years just about had passed. He had less than 2 years, just about 2 years left to get this case, two cases, Mar-a-Lago and January 6th, investigated, deal with the obvious looming immunity issue, charged and tried before the 2024 election. There was never any way he was going to do that. So a lot of blame lays at Merrick Garland's feet. Remember, there was these Garland defenders who were like, you guys don't know what you're talking about. He's a stealth ninja. You don't know what he's doing behind. It's like, yeah, you do, because you'd be hearing about subpoenas every day. You'd be seeing all sorts of action. Instead, it's just like
evidence.
I mean, look, it's important that they get the rioters and the guys in face paint and horns and stuff, but that's all they did for two years, a year and a half. And there's now been reporting from the Washington Post, New York Times, from Evan Perez at CNN, every person who knows this, who has now reported, and I think Carol Lenig has a book coming up that I believe is going to say the same thing, that Garland, as you said, John, wanted no part of it, was hoping it would just sort of slide away out of memory, and he would never have to wrestle with this bear, but it didn't work out that way.
I think that just makes the point, though, that simply trying to reestablish the institutions is insufficient. We need active reforms.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And it's not just the people. I mean, how do you understand Todd Blanche? You worked with him for many years. How do you understand his transformation into Hatchet Man, to use your
phrase? Yeah. So Todd, you know, look, I publicly defended Todd when he was representing Trump in the hush money criminal case. And I was, Maggie Haberman wrote a piece. I went on record and I said something like, since when did we prosecutors become pearl clutchers about a criminal defense lawyer defending a criminal defendant? Like, we all know criminal defense lawyers. There's nothing, that's their job. And Todd didn't do anything illegal or unethical in that case. He did a good job. He defended his client. Now that he's in this position of power, all of those, he's stomping on these principles of neutral, independent justice. I mean, the Eric Adams case actually happened a little before Todd arrived, but the way they let Eric Adams off the hook in exchange for basically a political promise, the way they've refused to open an investigation of the Signal scandal, the way they've seemingly, we don't know all the facts, but seemingly sort of shuffled the Tom Homan acceptance of $50,000 off without a thorough investigation, the way that they're, you know, saying they're going to investigate the people who heckled Donald Trump at a seafood restaurant for racketeering. You know, it's like Todd has lost his compass. And I don't have a better explanation.
Do you think he always had it in him, or is this just someone drunk on power on like a partisan,
I don't know.
Becoming increasingly hyper-partisan.
I really don't know. I mean, look, this has been a ticket to, you know, I mean, look, Todd took a gamble, and I give him credit. When he took that Trump representation, nobody wanted it. Everyone was too scared that they would be drummed out of the largely liberal New York media circle. And Todd did it, and he rolled the dice, and he won.
He said, I see, I might get myself a golden ticket.
I mean, and he did. So, I can't get inside his head.
So great, but again, it's only worth the damn if people enforce the law, both the spirit and the letter. And otherwise, you get your party to the destruction of the system. What do you think of the law firms that took the knee to Donald Trump and how that's looking in the rearview mirror? Because they were offering, oh, just a couple of pro bono for anti-Semitism and defending vets. No problem.
I was critical of those law firms and universities from the start unequivocally. And I think that's absolutely right. First of all, I'm sure that I said many, you know, five times on air, every one of these law firms or colleges who fights and goes to court will win. And they all have so far because it's so obviously, I mean, the reason Trump targeted these law firms, again, give Trump credit. There's no pretext involved. He's not trying to be polite. If you look at those executive orders on the law firms, Wilmer, Covington, all down the line, he just says, Covington, you're representing Jack Smith. Screw you. Wilmer, you, I forget which is which. You know, you hired someone who worked on Bob Mueller's team. Here's your punishment. It's overtly retributive. The colleges are a little pretextual in that they're all under the guise of fighting anti-Semitism. I mean, look, I would like to see colleges do better at fighting anti-Semitism, but, sure. but telling Harvard you have to hire an outside auditor to come in and survey your entire student body and faculty's ideological and political views, and then we'll tell you if it's okay. That has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. Cutting off funding for medical research has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. So I've said this as a Jewish person, like, don't use that as a pretext for what you're really trying to do here. No, thank you on that.
Yeah, well, they are. Let's talk about the assaults on media and free speech, going after news organizations, suits against the New York Times, against the Wall Street Journal, threats of suits against any other entity, and apparently media capture right now of sort of, you know, administration allies, you know, getting ideological enforcers and expanding their purview. First of all, let's just deal with the lawsuits themselves. Obviously, many of them get thrown out of court, but they have a chilling effect.
Yeah. Especially when you see people settling, right? I mean, to me, the most ridiculous of the lawsuits was the one against 60 Minutes. Was that CBS, right?
That's CBS.
And I mean, the claim was, you have wronged me by taking an interview with my opponent, Kamala Harris, editing it in a way that I believe was more favorable for her. First of all, I don't believe you have a defamation. Defamation means there's false information that was damaging to you and they knew it was false. I don't think you can say they made a person I don't like that I'm adverse to look better than they should have. I don't believe that's even a defamation, like definitionally. Beyond that, editing down a clip, I mean, you can't get paid for that. So I think they absolutely bent the knee. I think, you know, all the lawsuits have different merits or demerits, but I think what Trump has realized is sort of a soft underbelly here, which is some of these corporations are going to do the bottom line calculus, that it's cheaper to just pay up than to go to a trial, to drag this out, to pick a fight with the president. Just pay him. Like, what did they pay? 10 million, 12, whatever it was. Like, that's probably just an
ABC paid 16, which he keeps bringing up with
just right. Well, just in terms of the bottom line, it probably makes sense. I don't have their books. But if you were just a robot saying what's the best for our bottom line, that's probably the right move. And Trump, I think, recognized that. And then he holds them all up and they look like victories. And they are because these people bailed.
Right. But it's a mission driven business. And if you do take the knee, then you're compromised. Yeah. And it's never the end.
Yep, exactly.
It's never
the end. And so, look, I applaud, you know, so far Wall Street Journal has stood up in the suit over the Epstein reporting. And we'll see if they collapse. You know, the thing Trump never doesn't seem to calculate here is in all these defamation cases, if they get past motion to dismiss, you're into discovery. If that Wall Street Journal case, I mean, if the Wall Street Journal does not win on a motion to dismiss, Trump's getting deposed under oath. What about his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein? Like, he's walking into this.
Yeah, but never going that far. It's about the threat. Right. It's the threat is part of the dance. It's part of the transaction. The transactional nature of the relationships, but that's what makes it so uniquely dangerous. Because if you're a smaller news organization, you can't afford the threat.
Yeah.
If you're independent, and you know, and do you understand the free speech rhetoric? Just as we saw the rhetoric of we're never going to politicize our enemies. I mean, as just at this point, unfortunately, revealed to be self-serving BS from a partisan perspective.
I was hoping, yes.
I mean, is there a worse free speech administration in history?
I'm not qualified to go back more than a few administrations, but I was hopeful.
Since the Adams administration.
Yeah, let's start it with Jefferson. I was hopeful that they would make good on this. Look, because I do think that there is, you know, our universities are overwhelmingly lean left, more so than the American populace. But you can't enforce that. You can't enforce political thought. You can't, it's up to them. It's not up to you to come in and say, I want an audit of your university. And we're going to, if you lean left here, we're going to push you this way. Like, that's just not the role of the government. That's antithetical to the First Amendment. So I think many or most or all of these decisions are viewpoint and content driven. And that's exactly what the First Amendment is concerned with. You know, Trump said the other day, it's just one of these things where he's talking offhand, but he says, I think that criticizing the president, giving negative coverage to the president, is really illegal. It's really legal. It's the most legal form of speech. You are, political speech is the most highly protected form of First Amendment speech. And who's the leader, you know, the president's most powerful person in the country. So I do not think they've been even-handed in any respect with respect to the First Amendment applications.
On the final point, you know, inside various newsrooms, including one that you and I, you know, both worked at the time, there were longstanding debates about whether you should cover Trump like any other candidate. And this is after January 6th. The people who argued you should felt it was sort of a high mind guarantee of being centrist, which is something I hold very dear. All right, I'm a card-carrying centrist. I think you need.
I know your resume.
But yeah. The other argument is it ignores context that is crucial to understanding what we're reaping now by what we sowed then.
Well, let me give that my view as a legal, you know, what I do here, legal analysis. For me, the best thing I can do is bring my experience to bear, and there's some things that I can explain. What this means, what happens next. There's some things that that proceed according to normal established rules, procedures, norms. But I also think it's part of my job, as we just did, to say, this is unlike anything. This is outside the established norms. This is outside the rules. We've not seen this before. We've never before seen a president openly, or as far as we know, even behind closed doors, say, you go prosecute this person because I'm against them politically, or I believe they're against me politically. So I think the best way I can handle that is explaining to our viewers when something, you know, there's times when I say this, it may seem crazy, but it's not unusual, or it happened before. But there's also times when I think it's necessary to say this is brand new. And sometimes the answer is we don't know what happens next. So that's how I approach it. I don't think there's an easy silver bullet solution to any of this. But I think you have to take case by case. And, you know, I also don't want to be the boy who cried wolf. Like, that's never my style. I don't think everything is an emergency. But I do think we are seeing, look, it's been.
Do you think this is an emergency?
I wrote my piece for New York Magazine essentially begins like DOJ has crossed a line now. The White House has crossed a line. And I do think this is one where I'm going to wave a flag. Yes.
And you think it's likely to get worse for at least 3 years, and then we'll have a chance at some reform?
I think so. I don't know what will stop it. I mean, a series of court defeats. Does Trump care? Does he really care if the case against Comey gets? I think he just wanted to get the cuffs on him. You know, I mean, I don't know that he'll literally be cuffed, but, you know, get his shot in. And then if he loses, he blames the judge and whatever. But Trump does not have normal litigation incentives, financially or otherwise. He likes the fight. He likes the point of it. Yeah.
Well, when we'll end on this. When you take someone who is a lawyer, or J.D. Vance, the vice president, who approvingly quoted or misquoted Andrew Jackson saying, I've read the justice's opinion, now I invite him to enforce it. What does that tell you about what's coming? And what is the legal backstop? Sounds like a lot of this is just rooted in decency and character and integrity. In the absence of that, you've got the rule, not the rule of law, you've got the law of rules.
I mean, our courts do not have an independent enforcement mechanism. That quote apparently is somewhat apocryphal, but but the point stands. I mean, it's like our monetary system. It's like, it's based on belief, right? Like, there's no inherent value to a dollar bill. We just believe that it has some value. So I do think, you know, look, they've come right up to the line of defying the courts. I don't quite think that they've definitely defied the spirit back in the immigration cases, but they've just played games right up to the point of defying an actual court or a tangible court order in a concrete way. And if they do that, I will be ready to throw the flag as well. I've already thrown the flag of they're playing games here, but that's, you know, I'll come back if that happens, because I will be calling that one out.
We've got more than 3 years. All right. Ali Honig, my friend, good to see you. Congratulations on the new book. And I appreciate the reference to Omar Litter and the Little and the Tall.
Omar said it best. It goes back to Machiavelli, but no one said it like Omar. You know that.
No one said it like John Mark.